Our first talk is The Psychology of Multi-Factor Authentication by William Brown.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. It's very great to be here. It's quite late, obviously, since I haven't adjusted to everyone else's time zones. Normally we get to travel and be in person, but instead I'm falling asleep here and everyone's bright and awake. All right, let's get this going. All right, so today I am here to talk to you about the psychology of authentication and how, you know, human interaction principles actually affect the security of our computer systems. But first, just a quick introduction. Who am I? Well, my name is William Brown. I'm a member of the SUSE Samba team as part of the Labs organization, but my day job is actually working on an LDAP server. I work on the 389 directory server as my primary job role. And in my research time, I work on a personal identity project called CunnyVM. I'm based in Queensland, Australia, which means that I'm in UTC plus 10. So the best way to get in contact with me if you have any questions or comments will be through my email, which is wbrown@suse.de. Now, before I get too far into the technical topics, I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about doors. Now, for all of our international guests, you probably won't know this individual. This is Ben Decry. He's a quite well-known speaker at many Australian and Australasian technical events where he often does developer advocacy for Auth0, which is a online identity management provider. And he's quite famous for this demo where he brings a door and authenticates to it with a web token. But doors are something that we all interact with. They keep things out that we don't want to come into our houses, such as, you know, the weather or animals. And they also keep things in, such as our pets. But doors are something with authentication. They have keys and bearer tokens. And as I mentioned for Ben, things like JWTs. But doors have a problem. Now, they need documentation. Why do they need this? It's a door. Okay, just for everyone who is here at the event, I'd like you to all put up your hand if you've gone to a door and you've tried to walk through it and it just wouldn't open and you look down and you see the sign that says pull. Just so that everyone knows on the recording, everyone's hand went up because everyone here is human and we've all had this happen to us. And the thing is that none of us here are stupid. Maybe something else is going on. Maybe there's something wrong with the door. Maybe the interface and that interaction has a problem. There's an entire field of study into human interaction and human factors as part of psychology. And this can be from simple things like doors or cutlery, cups, chairs, or even complex systems like a nuclear power plant or the cockpit of an airplane. When these interfaces don't match our human interaction principles, we as humans encounter issues. Three Mile Island is a nuclear disaster that occurred in 1979, and the cause was determined to be confusion by the operators about the controls that are pictured here in this image. The control room was confusing and ambiguous, and the operators were unable to see that something was actually going wrong with the power plant. They didn't know. But this wasn't the operator's fault. The problem was that the interaction with that interface was flawed. The incident at the time was investigated by Don Norman, and he has since gone on to author books and papers on design and interaction. He's also consulted for many companies and been influential in the evolution of many computer systems, such as Apple's computer interfaces. Through his work, he cited a set of principles about how humans interact with systems These are no means exhaustive, but they're a really good place to start for our initial understanding. And I understand that with English as a second language, some of these words may be, you know, unfamiliar, and so I will be explaining them shortly. These principles are visibility, affordance, consistency, mapping, feedback, and constraint. So let's go through them all. Visibility. Humans discover interaction elements of an interface by seeing what is possible to interact with. A button has a raised edge around it, or a door handle extends from the door. Perhaps there's a different color. For those of you who have never been to Brisbane, Australia, even without this, you would be able to recognize where is the button here to open the door. But this goes further than that. For people who might be blind, the surfaces are textured in unique ways to allow them to be visible for those people with other accessibility requirements. Perhaps the button emits a noise to help someone who is out to locate it. It's very obvious where the button is in this picture. Affordance. This is the attributes or details of control that tells a human how it works. For example, a dial turns, or a button is pressed, or a handle is pulled. This is often where our doors break down. Using the wrong type of control, they afford the incorrect action. For example, the door may have a vertical bar, which may indicate to pull, when in fact it is a push door. And this is where we all have our problems, where we fail to interact with that door properly. Consistency. Controls that look the same should behave the same. Two dials should both rotate, rather than, say, one pushing and one rotating. Taps are an excellent example of consistency. This tap's had its markings worn off, but we still know that cold is on the right and hot is on the left. Even this unmarked tap is usable for us. Mapping. This is the relationship between a control and what it influences. The knobs on a stove should be arranged in the same layout as the burners that exist. This picture is from a hotel room, and it's actually an example of poor mapping. And the reason for this is that the burners are horizontal, but the knobs are vertical. And this means that we have to substitute documentation for the poor design. Whereas if the knobs were, say, arranged also horizontally, we wouldn't need a graphical documentation because we'd know which knob maps to which burner. Feedback. When a control is used, there is a way to indicate that an action has occurred. A button depresses and an action occurs. A sound plays or an indicator might light and change. A lack of feedback is often the pedestrian crossing buttons in Australia and New Zealand, as pictured here. You don't know if it's been pressed. You can press the button and you get no feedback. So people will stand there and just keep pressing the button because they don't know if it's worked or not. And finally, constraint. Limits on a control to prevent invalid or unsafe use. For example, gas and water fittings screw in the opposite direction so that they can never be accidentally connected. Or car gearboxes will not allow you to put the car into reverse when you're going above a certain speed. I really don't encourage you to try that at home. Anyway, computers are also a system we interact with, and all of these principles apply in all of our interactions with computers, all the way from a graphical user interface to our programming APIs and how we interact with the code that we work on daily as developers. Because of this, companies like Apple, Microsoft, and even projects like KDE or Android provide human interface guidelines. These guidelines encompass the principles I've just covered, but also many more to help you design and have a good user experience. It's very important that these exist, not only for consistency, but accessibility. A lot of accessibility tools, such as screen readers, rely on you adhering to the frameworks that exist on that platform. So to go through this, I want to talk you through some of these elements I've discussed as we go through Apple's Xcode. So here we can see Apple's Xcode on my machine. Now, we can see that a menu has given obvious feedback because of the dropdown that has appeared when I click the element. And by using these menus, the Apple's inbuilt screen reader can find and talk about these elements to people who need other ways of interacting with this interface. The menu has consistent items that never change. They don't appear and disappear randomly, but they do show what is possible to be done at this point in time based on current constraints. And this is why elements become grayed out to show that they're inactive versus being black to show that they are interactable at this point in time. Keyboard shortcuts are listed next to the actions to aid in their discovery so that people can find these otherwise hidden power tricks so that people can, you know, find them in the future, like Command C or Command V. You would never know to use a keyboard shortcut if it wasn't told to you. Buttons are visually identifiable as a mouse interaction, separate from, say, a menu item or otherwise. And the location where we enter our text is very visually distinct from the mouse interaction spaces, affording that this is the area where we type. Now, when these rules are abused or broken on a computer, it feels like we're just standing in front of that door again. I really recommend you go to this website. Maybe not now, but later on. It's userinyourface.com. It's really an experience. According to my friend, she described it as, "I'm sure it's a trash fire on desktop, but it is something special on mobile." And this website really is very frustrating. But if you do go to it, I really encourage you to think about what were the interaction principles that were violated that caused your experience to be frustrating rather than pleasant. And of course, in the modern world, we have websites that weaponize these design principles to try to trick you into certain actions. For example, in this case, here is Reddit's website. When you open this on a iOS device, such as an iPad, you get this little menu at the bottom, and it shows you this Reddit app open that looks like the default option, but it doesn't give you an indication that it's going to take you away from the page. The continue to the website option is grayed out, pretending to be inactive, even though it works, abusing that consistency element to pretend to be a constraint. And of course, the horizontal distance between these options makes it hard for us as humans to make a mapping between the element on the left and the action on the right. Anyway, enough of that. Let's talk about something that I care about, which is authentication. And this is something that I feel like as a community, we value a lot, especially in terms of file shares and Active Directory elements. Authentication is a very important part of what we have to do. So for those who are not as embedded in this community yet, authentication is the process of identifying oneself to a service to access a resource. Now, these resources could be sensitive or worth money, which is why we need to know who is accessing them. But the service also needs to identify itself to me so that I can understand that it is legitimate. At this point in time, we use passwords, which is a shared secret. They were invented in 1960 at MIT as part of CTSS, where they were used to isolate CPU resources back in the day when CPUs were a much more limited resource compared to the modern world. In the words of the inventor of the password, they have, quote, "gotten out of hand." They were a quick fix. They were never meant to survive this long, and yet we still use them today. But of course, these resources have a value, and because they have a value, people who are illegitimate or not meant to access that resource want to get access to it. Perhaps they want free computing, perhaps they want free storage. So as a result, authentication and critically passwords have been attacked. This has led to an arms race. And of course, something that computers are very good at is guessing passwords really fast. So how do we fix this? Of course, we used a technical solution, such as asking users to change their password all of the time and making the user remember all of these complex password rules. So the rules that are given on screen at the moment, honestly, I would not have a good time if I was a student at this university trying to comply to these rules. And this is really difficult. But of course, beyond just computers being good at guessing passwords and us forcing weird rules onto people, there have been other attacks that have occurred that we need to worry about. People attempt to phish users. They try to trick them to visit fake websites and get details. Did anyone notice here that the URL on this authentication page was different to the one I showed you before? It's very subtly different. I changed the end to end. For those of you who are a consumer of Fastmail, don't worry, this domain is fake. I've done a Photoshop. Fastmail do an excellent job on security. But what happens here is that the consistency of this user interface is what tricks us. That we see the same authentication prompt for the login and we say, yes, this is the real website. But there's no visual change on, say, the URL bar or the password field to tell us that we're on a different domain, that actually we've stumbled into something that we probably should be more careful of. One could imagine a world where the domain was maybe hashed to display some emoji, or the password field had a unique pattern and color display before you entered in your content. This would be very visible to the human, and of course, would make it a lot easier to identify when you're on a different domain than you expect. And of course, we get onto further things than that. There are failures of us as developers when we are developing backend systems. Programming is really hard. Database breaches happen, password dumps occur. And of course, cryptography is a very difficult thing and not taught very well and very inaccessible in its own way. And so people use the wrong methods for storing passwords, say using cryptographic verification hashes rather than key derivation functions. And this has led to all kinds of attacks like rainbow tables or brute forces to recover original password from these breaches. It turns out programming sucks and has a very poor user experience. There's so few constraints and feedback. Anyway, this has led to attacks like credential stuffing, which is where people reuse passwords. Because passwords are hard to remember. Look at all of these arbitrarily complex rules we've made. So I'm just going to make one password and use it on every website. But of course, this means that because I've used it on one website, maybe I've used it on another. So when these breaches occur, an attacker will take this list of passwords and then replay it into other websites. And then maybe it will work. According to Microsoft, this is one of the highest causes of account breaches is credential stuffing attacks like this. So let's just look at like some of the things that we've tried to do with passwords to make them better, especially with password quality and putting that onto the human. There's all of these attacks that occur, such as, you know, keystroke logging or brute forcing or credential stuffing or phishing, and the quality of your password doesn't protect you from this. The modern attacks on a computer are counterintuitive to what we've been told to believe about a password. And the past advice that has been given has really done a lot of damage and caused people to take the wrong direction. Even with a strong password, phishing and other attacks can reveal it. And all of us are vulnerable to this. No one is above phishing. Password security today is 100% on you to get it right or to hold the phone correctly. We resorted to documentation to resolve our design flaws. So why do we still use passwords? They have no constraints to where they're used. They have poor feedback on their quality and inconsistent messages. And they don't even match human cognition in the way that we think about and memorize things. Why have we not gotten rid of these? Well, part of it is that they're very pervasive. They're everywhere. It's kind of the default. We assume that passwords are the way you access a system, and it's very hard to see other ways to imagine how you could log in. Developers like us we say, well, I can manage my passwords. Why can't the user? I'm good at this. Why can't they? Well, those users aren't subject matter experts in technical things. They might be subject matter experts in, say, tax law. Australian tax law terrifies me. So, you know, I'm glad I'm not a subject matter expert in that. But I also want my accountant to be secure. We also have problems with legacy technologies, technologies that hold us back from being able to develop new types of authentication methods. And these are things like LDAP, Kerberos, SASL. These are systems that are very hard to extend or develop or change now. And it's very hard to have the applications that consume these libraries also be extended to be able to actually use new authentication types if they existed. And then we even get to things like, say, smart cards. Well, smart cards require custom hardware, and that becomes a cost and accessibility issue. It's one thing for a major bank to buy smart cards for all its employees, but what about my next door neighbor? What about the person across the road who is on welfare? Why don't they deserve to have their identity secured just as well as I do? Thankfully, some of this has started to change. So let's talk about multi-factor authentication. TOTP or HOTP. These were introduced in 2011. This is a time-based one-time password or a hardware-based one-time password. The way that these work is that there is a private key in the device with a counter, such as the hardware token shown here, or perhaps it's an app on your phone and it uses the current Unix timestamp as its counter with the key. The value is hashed and then truncated into take the trailing bits. And then those trailing bits become the unique code displayed, such as on this device, 800501. The code will change the next time you press the button or when a time window passes, such as 60 seconds or 30 seconds. This OTP is typed in a login prompt, such as the example above. In some cases, it's a second stage that follows the password verification, such as on Twitter, where you enter your password and then on the next page it will show you. But in other applications, it's common for legacy authentication stacks, which can't have new extensions added, to use a system like this, where they jam the password and the OTP into a single field. On the server, the password is split based on the OTP length and verified individually. Going back to our design constraints, this is a poor design. The password field now has an inconsistent use. It has two inputs. It's not clear that you need the OTP in the same field. And even if you were to document and say password plus OTP, well, some users may take that as literally putting a plus between the two values. Again, it's not a very good human interaction. And in other ways, it's not afforded that you may need to use the OTP in these cases. It's also still vulnerable to phishing. Because a person may have to type it in, there's no extra verification of, say, the domain name. And the adoption is hard. Users don't like the experience. Even at major businesses that I'm aware of, which have mandatory multi-factor authentication policies, users try to avoid using the OTP tokens at all possible, to the point where I believe that there is a service for Duo which you can sign up your account and it will automatically verify any OTP that's sent to your account just so that you don't have to. Yes, people don't want to have to work with an extra device or manual typing of this code. And then there's problems like these tokens may desynchronize if you press the button too many times, or TOTP especially can confuse people with the timer. So for example, when TOTP is approaching the end of the validity window, you may have only 3 seconds to type it in. You've typed it in, you press enter and it fails. Why? I don't understand why it failed, but suddenly my code is different. We as developers again may know this and we race to enter it, or we kind of wait and then we enter the token. But this isn't the way that other people think about it. And again, because these tokens may be used infrequently depending on your system and they're separated physically from your machine, they're easy to lose or forget. They're not a device that we always put in our pocket whenever we walk out of the door. And of course, you might need many tokens as it's one token per service. So, for example, I think I have more than 10 on my free OTP install, and it's very hard to distinguish which token is which besides a tiny piece of grey text at the bottom of the token listing, which is very frustrating. This makes it hard to map the relationship between a token and the service that I'm authenticating to. Of course, there are browser extensions that can help us here. There are some extensions which can generate the token for us and automatically fill it in. These can do stronger checks on the domain name in question, which can prevent phishing. Some people argue that as the token is on the device now, there is a risk of that token being compromised because it's an untrusted extension, or the fact that the device itself now contains the token and so it could be compromised. But of course, if your device is compromised, you have a much bigger problem. Your session cookies could be stolen post-authentication anyway, or your one-time password could be keylogged instead. And there's many other types of data that is on your laptop besides your session tokens that you probably don't want stolen. So comparing this up to passwords though, look, TOTP and HTTP do stop most of the dangerous attacks, really except for phishing. They can be low cost and somewhat accessible. Free OTP on phones, even though it has many flaws of accessibility in terms of the psychology elements, it's still better than nothing. The browser extensions also are free and are, again, low cost. But the problem is that it has an inconsistent UI for entry, there can be very poor mapping of those tokens to the services, and very few constraints on the entry to incorrect services. Again, we have an authentication system which, yes, it's better, but it still doesn't mesh with the way that people interact with our systems, and it leads to mistakes and frustration. So let's talk about WebAuthn, also known as U2F. It was developed and released largely in 2019 when it was finalized. This uses ECDSA on a coprocessor, generally via a USB interface. There has been some discussion of projects like Firefox actually shipping a SOFS token within the web browser, which is a really great idea. It can be permanently in your computer due to your small size. I can't really show you because I'm recording from my MacBook, also I'd lift it up and show you my YubiKey Nano, but I have a YubiKey permanently in the side of my machine. So it's associated with the device. It can never leave it and I can't lose it. If I lost my MacBook, I'd probably be pretty upset for other reasons. And in some cases, it may even be built into the device. For example, Chrome on macOS can use Touch ID as a WebAuthn device. So how does it work? So you have a relying party. This might be your web service. And you have a client which wants to access that. And of course, within that client, which there is a U2S, Within that client, there is connected a U2F device. The client says, I would like to log in. So the relying party begins the process. It sends a challenge, an application ID, and a handle to the client to verify. The client then initiates a communication with the U2F device, consisting of the handle, the challenge, the domain name, the channel ID, and other parameters. The U2F device then derives a new private key based on the origin and application ID, and with that derived private key, signs the challenge and increments a counter, and then returns that to the client. And of course, the client then proxies that back through to the relying party, who can verify that the signed data matches the public key that was previously stored during registration. But this is the critical step here. During this, the private key is derived not only from a secret within the device, but in combination with the domain name. This means that if you change any character, even a single bit flip within the domain name, a different private key will be derived, meaning that the challenge will not be signed with the same key. This prevents phishing because it will always use the wrong derived key. And of course, because you can't replay the challenge and response due to the fact that it is generated per attempt, you then can't do other types of attacks as well. It also means that with one device, you can service many websites because every domain has a unique key. It also requires physical interaction, simply to touch the device. And this is really important. It's visually indicated through the device flashing and on-screen prompts as demonstrated here. This makes it very easy for the individual to know that they need to take an action to authenticate. But it also means that a compromised device cannot use this authentication mechanism or steal the keys. They're inside of a coprocessor. A human has to interact with that device to say, yes, I approve this authentication to continue. Which means that if this feedback is occurring, but you didn't initiate it, perhaps your machine has been compromised. And in the future, there are keys like Touch ID on your Mac, or Yubico, and I think Bayesian have keys with fingerprint readers in it. WebAuthn in the standard can insist on verified authentication beyond just simple touching to interact, but going further to pins and biometric verification. And without that biometric verification, it cannot sign the challenge. This in itself means that your WebAuthn token becomes multiple factors, physical possession and your presence, not just anyone's presence, but yours. Theft of the token does not mean compromise. So it's really important to see how these design factors make a big difference here. Not just these technical and cryptographic elements, which I know that we are all so excited about, or maybe that's just me, but that human interaction is really what makes a big difference here. It has great visibility. It's connected to your device. It's not separated from your device. It's clear how to use and interact with the device, and the prompts are very noticeable. The affordance is great. All you have to do is touch it. No messing around, retyping, whatever. All you do is you touch when you want to auth. It gives you consistency between sites that use WebAuthn. Everything is the same. It's touch to auth. It has excellent mapping. It does one thing, and you know what it does. It's not confusing. It has great feedback to you, the user, by blinking and giving you on-screen prompts, so you know when something is occurring. And of course, it has constraints that are not just enforced at the key and cryptographic level. It prevents this kind of incorrect usage that we would otherwise see causing TOTPs or passwords to be compromised. So let's talk about the future of authentication here. The NIST SP800-63B Digital Identity Guidelines. I'm sure it's not everyone's idea of a fun reading experience, but it is a very valuable reading experience. And as much as sometimes we don't like some of the publications that come out of governments in terms of computer security, I believe that this document is actually very good. It really says that multi-factor authentication is a very important thing, and that human interaction is a very key element of how we make a secure system. It also talks about the ability to use things like single sign-on so that you can rely on a provider that has WebAuthn or TOTP properly, and then trust those credentials as they move through a network. It also allows you to audit your systems a lot more simply in terms of the authentication steps, perhaps not the authorization though. But we're also seeing a strong move towards devices authentication. I think I said this last year, and I've said it in a number of talks, but we are getting to a point where your device is unable to be separated from you. Your phone is a very personal thing. And so what will happen is that you will authenticate to your device, and then your device will continue to authenticate you. Great examples of this is even just within the WebAuthn standard, or seeing where the development of these products is going. Things like Android Key, Touch ID, or the Firefox soft token associated to your user profile. WebAuthn may even become a single factor of authentication for the majority of use cases, where the verified options plus a password are used in higher assurance areas where you need true multi-factor. We as developers, however, should all be used to this. SSH keys. SSH keys really represent a form of the device as authentication. I log into my laptop contains SSH keys, and those SSH keys continue to identify me as who I am. But of course, I think the one that's really important for us here is looking at things like Windows Hello. Windows Hello, again, is that extension of the device's authentication. And the way that it works is separated from, say, an individual machine compared to maybe the device is joined to a pure Azure AD environment, or the machine is in a hybrid Azure AD and on-site Active Directory environment, or perhaps even just an Active Directory environment. And the way that this works, of course, differs between all of these configurations and will have effects, probably on the Sample project, in how these, in how the file server especially is authenticated to. And I'm not an expert in this area, I will leave that to others. So for example, in one case, Windows Hello can be used to perform a pkinit to get a new Kerberos token within the, I think it's the on-site version of Active Directory. But of course that involves enrollment and other things. But this is a really good example of where the device and that TPM within it is becoming part of the authentication workflow that we really need to think about, and that actually makes our users and our users much more secure. So I want to just wrap up to, you know, leave on a really major point, which is that humans are always part of our systems. Computers don't exist without humans. We always have to think about that human interaction as a result. And especially to make our systems secure, we have to think about their behavior. If a person is continually making a mistake, maybe the interface, the computer, and the way that we designed it has a problem, not the human. I'd like to finish up with a quote from a paper by Don Norman called The Truth About Unix, which is a great read and I highly recommend it. And the paper finishes with this: understanding the psychology behind people's expectations, needs, and behaviors is the foundation of great design. People have mental models of the way they expect things to work. Violating these connections can create frustration or confusion. The price to be paid for design oversights may or may not include potential loss of life. System designers take note. Design the system for the person, never for the computer, never even for yourself. People are also information processing systems with varying degrees of knowledge, varying degrees of experience. A friendly system treats users as intelligent adults who, like normal adults, are forgetful, distracted, thinking of other things, and not quite as knowledgeable as they would like to be. Thank you very much. I hope that this has been enlightening. And I think if the messages being sent to me are correct, that there is still some time for discussion. 10 minutes left, apparently. So if you want, you can ask me some questions in my half asleep state. Hey, someone said it was great. Thank you, Jeremy. I liked the part where Jeremy put his hand up because he couldn't open the door, because like all of us, we can't push and pull. It's okay. I do the same thing. How do I get... Oh, okay, hang on. Now I've got to fight my computer for various reasons. Stop sharing. Q&A, there's a question. How are these improved authentication mechanisms? Summer 3, authentication token, changes needed. Okay, to Steve's question, I'm not qualified to answer this question. I honestly don't know enough about that area to be able to confidently answer that question. And so I would want to leave that to other people. Tom, sorry, I should read it out for the recording. The question that Steve asked for the recording is that how can these improved authentication mechanisms be integrated into storage protocols? For example, SPNego encapsulates tokens so they're opaque. Are there changes required? How does this work with claims? And again, I'm not confident that I could answer this question properly, and so I do think that, you know, you may need to do further research, but, you know, sorry about that. Okay, so Tom has asked about me mentioning the server name being part of the validity checking. What about DNS attacks? Okay, so DNS attacks, the thing about that is that DNS is always assumed to be insecure. And your security in that situation comes from TLS validation. That when you go to a website that has an invalid CN or subject alt name, that you will be prompted for it at a different level. The majority of security on the way that it works online is that we always assume DNS must be considered insecure. And so, of course, you require TLS before you can do this kind of negotiation. And that is what stops DNS attacks from hijacking things like, you know, your WebAuthn negotiations and preventing that man in the middle. So that's how that's prevented. Why bother to check the name at all? So the reason to check the name at all is that you want to derive a different key per website, so that if one website is compromised, the public key of that token can't be associated to the public key in, say, another website compromise. And it also means that you can't replay challenges from one website that maybe you did man in the middle to another website that you could. So you do need that because, you know, let's say, for example, that someone does do the TLS validation, but they used fast nail instead of fast mail, then you could just replay the challenges. So by using the different domain name, you prevent that kind of attack. And by using TLS, you prevent the hijacking of the DNS for the same domain name. So that's where it kind of starts to layer in and then the broader ecosystem for protecting that kind of thing. You might ignore those. Not everyone does. And certainly there have been a lot of changes recently within Chrome and Firefox to deal with the invalid cert click-through things. And a lot of people actually do, like, not click through. Sorry, I should repeat the question. Jeremy has said, everyone ignores or clicks through the TLS invalid cert. Does that compromise security of WebAuthn? So a lot of, in theory, yes. If you click through it, then yeah, you're opening yourself up to phishing. But at the same time, if you click through that warning with a password, you would also be opening yourself up to the same attacks or same with TOTP. And so this is why a lot of the browsers have done a lot of work to improve the user interaction elements of those TLS messages. They've, for example, changed the way that the, 5 minutes. The way that the notifications are presented, the coloring or where the click-through buttons are to, and even the language that's used so that it's less technical and may give a better description for a non-technical person to help them see that they should not click through. So we might still click through because we have a different understanding of what's going on, but those changes have actually, I think Chrome often does publish surveys on this. They've actually shown that based on these changes they've made, those click-through rates have dropped. And so as a result, you know, it has actually improved the security for a lot of people, which is a really great thing. If with Jeremy has said, with protocol, a server protocol where there's no ability to prompt the user that the TLS is invalid, the auth should just fail here. So this one, I think, very similar to something like LDAP. If you can't verify the certificate of the LDAP server, yes, you should immediately fail. And this is certainly the default in all of the open LDAP libraries and many other authentication systems, where if you can't verify the TLS certificate of the connected service, then you do immediately fail, and then you start handing that back up the stack. And I think that is the correct answer here. Who likes my background, by the way? This is Cairns in Queensland. I highly advise you to go. This is on Green Island. Really good place. All right, well, no more questions. So everyone is probably a bit in shock. Maybe I talked too quickly. But thank you all for your time and thank you all for listening. And I'm, you know, just a quick shout out to the conference organizers that it's great work to actually have still put this event on with everything that's been going on in the world, and it's still a really valuable resource for us all to be able to share these ideas. And so I'd like to thank you all for your work to make this happen, and I hope everyone has been enjoying it and taking something from it. So I hope you all have a great day, and I hope you all learn something new while I go and fall asleep, and I'll watch all of your talks later on.
Thank you very much for your talk. So we will go now into a very short break. After that, about 3 minutes or something like that.